When I covered the siege of Sarajevo, I heard stories about a slim, tall, renegade Saudi prince who reportedly went there a couple of times, bearing sacks of money. Our Muslim brothers are being killed, our women raped, our children massacred, all under the eye of the United Nations, the prince was said to have declared. The West sends blue helmets and dried beans. We bring you guns and men. Wasn't until later in the 1990s that I learned he was Osama bin Laden. Over the years, and especially since 2001, bin Laden's light, milky eyes and gray, waterfall beard became the portrait of evil for Americans, not just Americans. A few years ago, I was writing a novel about the siege of Sarajevo and went back to find reports of some of bin Laden's remarks in the early 1990s, wondering how a man who'd killed so many people, including so many Muslims in Kenya, Tanzania, Egypt, and New York, had become so compelling a figure that Osama was reportedly the most popular boy's name in many parts of the Arab world. I wasn't surprised to find that he traced much of what he despised back to Jews. That song has been sung for centuries. He assailed all non-Muslims as crusaders. But bin Laden had a pattern of rolling grains of truth into fantasies. When he told an Arab newspaper, oil is the elixir of their lives in the West, I remembered all of the American columnists who'd said that too. When he admonished young Muslims to avoid being dazzled by Western music, movies, and materialist toys, he almost sounded like a beleaguered suburban father in Shaker Heights. They take your soul and give back nothing, he said. He told Arab interviewers, I am rich and I live among refugees. Although, of course, bin Laden spent millions to kill people and to try to save his own skin. The only inspiration he offered was his willingness to kill. He mocked Americans for whisking U.S. troops out of Somalia in 1993 after 19 U.S. soldiers died in Mogadishu, telling Britain's Channel 4, Americans are afraid of death. They are like little mice. But the young who rallied to him, he said, know that those who are not killed are going to die one day, and that the most honorable way to die is to die for the sake of God's cause. He seemed to end each presentation by saying, may the peace of the Prophet be upon you, invoking the name of the great religious leader he professed to serve as some kind of linguistic lather that he thought could rinse cold blood from his knuckles. And you're listening to NPR News. Curtain up. Light the lights. Play it, boys. You either got it. One of the geniuses who helped make Maria and Tony, the Sharks and the Jets, Baby and Mama Rose household names, died after a long signature career. Arthur Lawrence, who directed and wrote some of the most beloved classics of stage and screen, has died. He was 93. He was part of that quartet of talents that created West Side Story, along with Bernstein, Sondheim, and Robbins. And just 2 years later, Arthur Lawrence wrote Gypsy. And years later, the screenplay for The Way We Were. He also directed revivals of Gypsy and West Side Story. Patti LuPone starred in a 2008 revival of Gypsy, directed by Arthur Lawrence. She joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So what was he like?
Well, he was a very vibrant, funny, emotional, passionate man.
And always easy to work with?
When I worked with him, I only worked with him on Gypsy, and he was extremely easy to work with. He loved our company, and he loved our company, and it showed. It showed every day in rehearsal, and it showed every time he showed up at the theater once we were in performance. And we were always thrilled when he came backstage or when he was in the room. It was a joyful, inspiring, and lesson-learning time with him.
Yeah. How do you think he changed the musical and American theater?
He was a great playwright, and I think his ideas, he was fearless. And he was associated with other great artists of that you know, quintessentially American art form, the American musical. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the combination of Arthur and Stephen and Leonard Bernstein, I mean, how can you beat that?
If I might, with respect to a great man, a lot of people said he could just be a little, well, the word that they often use is prickly. He could be prickly.
Yes, I think it's true, yeah. I don't think he suffered fools. And I think that he was bluntly honest. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I really don't.
Apparently, the revival of Gypsy, in which you starred, was intended to be a tribute to Tom Hatcher, who was his partner for more than 50 years. What kind of partnership were they?
Well, you know, I didn't really know Tom. Tom was dying when we started this. And it was the reason we started this. Tom apparently said to Arthur, you have to do Gypsy with Patty. And he didn't say it because he wanted me to play the character of Rose. He said it because he wanted to keep Arthur alive. And what was on the horizon for Arthur was a production of Gypsy.
What do you think Arthur Lawrence will mean in American theater history?
You know, an era has passed. He'll be considered one of the greats, for sure.
Patti LuPone, who worked with Arthur Lawrence in the Broadway musical Gypsy. Arthur Lawrence died Thursday at the age of 93. Miss LuPone, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for including me.
Somewhere a place for us, peace and quiet and open air wait for us somewhere.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Rob Lowe has had boyish good looks for so long, it's easy to resent him as undeserving. As a kid in Dayton, Ohio, he knocked on Liza Minnelli's hotel room door and stayed to chat, have some chocolates before she told him, "See you in Hollywood, kid." And just a few years later, he was, in fact, a Hollywood star. But Rob Lowe is also a child of divorce, a veteran of alcoholism. Some of his career has gone up and down. He's written a great Hollywood memoir, Stories I Only Tell My Friends. And by the way, his friends range from Francis Ford Coppola to Martin Sheen and Michael Dukakis to Mike Myers. Rob Lowe joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
When your family moved to California, you didn't exactly run around with the dead-end kids there, did you, as you look back on it?
Well, no. I mean, for the first time, I met people my own age that wanted to act and that wanted to be filmmakers. And as opposed to being beaten up for it, I found friends who were like-minded, and they were my next-door neighbors, the Sheens. But it was great to fall in with a crowd that had similar likes.
Yeah. Speaking of days as a Hollywood teenager, what was it like to get to the home of a girl named Jennifer and have Cary Grant answer the door?
Well, in a show of exactly how callow I was as a youth, I wasn't really aware of Cary Grant's filmography. Mm-hmm. I knew Cary Granite from the Flintstones. That I knew. Yeah. So when I went to her house and we were going to watch my very first television appearance on an after-school special, and he said, "Young man, do you mind if I watch with you?" I thought, "Yeah, you crazy old guy. Sure, whatever. Come on in." And ignorance truly is bliss, because if I'd have known what I know about Cary, obviously, today, I would have been petrified. But it worked out great, because at the end, he was very kind and really gracious. And he said, "I thought you were quite good. You reminded me of a young Warren Beatty." Now, Warren Beatty, I knew. So it was a good day.
You first gathered a lot of attention in The Outsiders, directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Right.
Of course, that's a film with Matt Dillon, Patrick Swayze,
Tom Cruise, Diane Lane.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. Did you all know you'd be famous?
It's interesting. The movie did very well, but we thought the movie was going to be Star Wars. It was not. We never thought we would all be famous. Mm-hmm. We all were. So it was slightly a different experience from what we thought. I don't think any of us thought that it would be the beginning of, for a lot of us, a very, very, very long, long, long career. But it was, and it was an amazing, amazing launching pad for many of us.
When did you start drinking in a harmful way?
Well, that's just the thing, is when does it become harmful? I mean, mm-hmm. on the outsiders, this is how different movie making is. We would get in the van, and they would have beers for us. Now, some actors were 15 years old.
Yeah.
I was just 18. And you drink a beer and think nothing of it. So mm-hmm. I started then. And I think incrementally, without even knowing it, it became just a big part of my life, to the point where it was such a part of my life that I decided that I needed to go and get help, and did.
You know, it's inescapable, as you read through the book, that there were times, let me put this nicely, you were your big star doing drugs, drinking, having romances left and right.
Or as my mother would say, God rest her, burning the candle at both ends.
And you were not happy, were you?
No, and people say, why is there so much alcoholism and drug addiction around Hollywood? And I don't think it has anything to do with Hollywood. I think that people are drawn to Hollywood who are looking to fill something missing in them. Mm-hmm. And performing does that. But then when you reach the mountaintop, you realize you're still the same. It didn't fill you up.
Well, 1988 Democratic Convention.
Yes.
There was a new technology called portable video, I guess. And you, two women in a hotel room in Atlanta. This was before YouTube.
It was before YouTube. And also it was the era, just even in politics, where it was still wild and woolly. You know, the tradition of hard drinking, hard charging, political roughnecks was still really alive and well. Conventions were, it's not the sanitized, infomercial, corporate, no surprises allowed conventions that we have today. It's almost unimaginable to go back and remember what that was like. That said, one of those big wild nights, you know, we all go out to a club. I try to get in, and they won't let me in without my ID, which I had left back in the car. So once I finally got my ID and went in, it never occurred to me that anybody else would not be 21. But, you know, I went out, met two girls, had some fun, and used the new technology as everybody does today. I was just a groundbreaker. And it was a different world, different time.
It's amazing. Well, you have a note about this, how big that story was.
It's shocking. I mean, this is how I knew I was in some serious trouble. As I turned on the TV, I led the evening news, Tom Brokaw. And the second story literally was, and in Tiananmen Square today, in the 6,000-year history of China, democratic uprising is rearing its fantastic head. That was the second story was Tiananmen Square. This is unbelievable. It's now, like, you know, every actor in the world has to have, you know, a naked photo in the internet.
Yeah. I wonder, did your friends stick with you through that? Or I guess we say, did your real friends, did you lose some others and not hear from some other people?
Well, look, I don't want to paint the picture that my real friends deserted me. I certainly had some friends. But I got to be honest, I did a lot of work for a lot of people and traveled a lot of miles on behalf of candidates and, you know, the party and things like that, and they ran for the hills. Yeah. Looking back, I get it. It's called politics for a reason. But it definitely influenced and gave me a new view into what that relationship between celebrities and politicians and activism is really all about at the end of the day.
Well, forgive me for being this blunt to the point of vulgar, but when you say you learned what it's all about at the end of the day, you mean that they're using you?
Yeah. You know what it is? I think that it's celebrities and politicians sort of bask in each other's reflective glory, each one being filled by the other, a part that they're individually missing.
Mm. So you fill in the glamour for them, they fill in the
gravitas.
Yeah. Boy. There's a wonderful poetic touch in the fact that you wind up in the West Wing. Sam Seaborn writing speeches for President Bartlett, played by Martin Sheen, when you had at least partly grown up at the Sheen household.
Yeah. And so whenever Sam and Martin would have scenes, they were so charged for me because of my history with him. And I like to think that that was captured in the show.
I have to ask this given the times in which we live. Do you have any thoughts about your old friend Charlie Sheen you'd like to share?
Well, you know, Charlie and I have been in contact up until, it's been about 5 weeks now, but when he began this sort of troubling time, we were talking via text. And, you know, listen, it's tough because I've known him since he was 13, and I love him. And I love Martin and the whole family. And I'm also, you know, 21 years sober, so I have a perspective that's probably unique to his experience. You know, he knows where I am. He knows I'm available. He knows I'm ready to help. But he's doing it his way. And part of me has to, you know, respect that. He's not being a hypocrite. I don't agree with it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it sort of is what it is.
Since you've been there and back, what does make a difference to someone to be able to turn your life around?
You need to literally be done. When I was ready, when I went to rehab, if they told me to go stand in a corner with my clothes off, standing on my head, I would have done it. I was just done. I wanted a new life. Different people take different events to get them to that place. Some people have to go way, way down, and other people don't.
Mr. Lowe, a pleasure. Thanks so much for all your time.
Thank you. This has really been fun. I appreciate it.
Rob Lowe, his memoir, Stories I Only Tell My Friends. And you can hear Rob Lowe read from his book about his friendship with John Kennedy Jr. at NPR.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The United Nations says world food prices are still near record highs. Grain prices in particular continue to move higher. Poor people around the world who feel price increases most suffer an especially disproportionate burden. Global prices are driven by many factors, for example, the strength of the U.S. dollar. A new study finds that global warming is also having a measurable effect on world grain prices. And NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Many studies have projected that higher temperatures and altered rainfall from global climate change will ultimately take a toll on four of the most important crops in the world: rice, wheat, soy, and corn, which some call maize. The new study finds that the effects are already starting to be felt. Wolfram Schlenker at Columbia University is a co-author.
So we find it for two crops, which is maize and wheat. There has actually been a decline in yields if you account for the trend in climate, especially a warming trend that we've observed over the last 30 years.
The scientists look specifically at places where there are warming trends, and sure enough, they found these staple crops weren't doing quite as well. For rice and soy, declines in some places were offset by productivity boosts elsewhere in the world, so there was no overall change. But they did see a change for wheat and corn. Schlenker says the losses caused by warming thus far are still smaller than the gains made through improved agriculture.
We're not saying that yields have gone down, just to make this clear. What we're saying is that yields are lower than what they would have been without the climate trends. So yields have still been going up over the last 30 years.
The study is published online by Science magazine. It shows that these crops have declined about 5% over what they would have been in the absence of warming. That sounds small until you consider that these crops are worth globally about $1 trillion a year. 5% of $1 trillion?
So it's still $50 billion more in expenditures on food, which I think is quite sizable.
And that number's probably just the beginning. Jerry Nelson at the International Food Policy Research Institute says as the planet heats up in the coming decades, the 5% loss today could easily grow to 20%.
Definitely do not consider shrugging that off. We can expect to see higher prices that are going to cause problems around the world.
And most of those problems hit people who can afford it the least.
Who gets hurt most are those people who spend most of their money on food, and who spend most of their money on eating commodities directly rather than as we do in the U.S., where the food price that we pay that's actual commodities is relatively small.
A doubling of wheat prices might only add a dime to the cost of a $2 loaf of bread, he says. But double the price of rice, and people who fill their food bowl with that grain every day will really feel it. Americans are also insulated from this effect for another reason. The new study found that the effects of warming have not been felt evenly around the world. Again, Wolfram Schlenker.
Well, the one big exception we actually found is the United States. So this is the one place that doesn't have a big temperature trend.
America's breadbasket has not warmed. So thus far, American grain farmers have been fortunate. Professor Gene Talkley at Iowa State University says farmers in the Midwest have instead dealt with a long-term trend of additional rainfall in that area.
Farmers are very good at adapting to climate change, adapting to anything. And when the ranges of climate are not too extreme, they can and they are adjusting.
Midwestern farmers have adapted to the added wetness by spraying more pesticides to control fungus, by planting more per acre, and by buying bigger machines to cope with the wetter fields, he says. And Tockley says the farmers will surely be able to adapt to at least some degree of warming, which is likely sooner or later.
But that's a real critical issue of what is the range of temperature or climate conditions to which we can adapt and when do we exceed those.
Many other farmers around the world are already beginning to struggle with those higher temperatures. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Lawrence Wright won the Pulitzer Prize for his investigation of the rise of Al-Qaeda in the book The Looming Tower. Mr. Wright, who's now a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, joins us from member station KUT in Austin. Larry, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So where does the death of Osama bin Laden leave Al-Qaeda?
Well, it's been an organization in crisis even before this. You know, they were under a lot of pressure, all in hiding, trying to pull off another significant action, which they've been unable to do. And then suddenly you have the Arab Spring come along where they seem even more irrelevant than they have been in the last few years. So from that perspective, this is a mortal moment for Al-Qaeda. But that's not to say that it's dead. So I suspect we'll continue to see Al-Qaeda for a while.
Do you foresee Osama bin Laden becoming martyr over the next few months or a fading memory?
I think his memory will be divided. I think it'll be fade in the West, but probably not for a while among many of the people that have glorified in him up till now. What he's done that is unfortunate is create a template for future groups who may not be radical Islamists, but may have any number of different kind of political causes behind them. But if they want to look at how to create a disproportionate effect on the world, they may well look at Al-Qaeda.
You've said in interviews this week and suggested in an article you have coming out this weekend in The New Yorker that Osama bin Laden, and let me quote your own words, was essentially sheltered by Pakistani intelligence and military units.
I think it's unlikely that elements of the Pakistani intelligence were unaware of bin Laden's presence in their lair in Abbottabad. ISI has a long history of dealing with radical Islamist groups that they either helped create or continued to nurture, such as the Taliban and Lashkar-e-Taiba.
I struck by a piece, maybe you read it too, Philip Shannon in the Daily Beast had this week, where he quoted some Pakistani intelligence officials as saying, look, if we knew where Osama bin Laden was, why didn't any of us, being so famously corrupt, turn him in and claim that big reward?
Well, I think the answer to that is that the Pakistani military and ISI were claiming a big reward every year in terms of the military aid that this country was giving to Pakistan in order to find bin Laden. They were in the looking for bin Laden business. If they found him, they'd be out of business.
And what are the real consequences now? I mean, what might you say to Americans that say, no reason to keep paying the Pakistani military?
My feeling has been for several years that we should scale back drastically in the amount of military aid that we provide to that country. I think we have undermined civil society in Pakistan by overly endowing the Pakistani military, which has used the money to misappropriated, I should say, the money to arm itself against India, our nominal ally, and may have used a lot of that money to amplify its nuclear program, in which through A.Q. Khan, their leading nuclear scientist, they went and sold those plans and materials to our worst enemies in the world. This is what a harvest that we have reaped in our relationship with the Pakistani military.
Does the image of the United States change much following this week in the region?
Yes, I think this sense of capacity and reach has been underscored all over the world, not just in South Asia and the Middle East. And I think the sense of resolve is very apparent. I think there's going to be a delicate tone that has to be adopted in this country that is short of triumphalism, but also a sense of certainty about who we are and where we're going to prosecute and where we're going to go from here. I don't think we have really settled on in our own minds. What will the world be like without bin Laden?
Lawrence Wright, staff writer for The New Yorker, his article about U.S. and Pakistan appears in the upcoming issue of the magazine. Thanks so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks again.